بشار وقد نشيل البشر بهم مثل الهوية سوريا بدها
حرية
سوريا بدها
حرية
وقد نشيل البشر بهم مثل الهوية سوريا بدها
حرية
سوريا بدها
حرية
نشيل البشر بهم مثل الهوية سوريا بدها
حرية
سوريا بدها
حرية.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Mostert. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bassam Haddad, who is the director of the Middle East Studies program at George Mason University and a visiting professor at Georgetown University. He serves as founding editor of the Arab Studies Journal. And his latest book on Syrian political economy is The Political Economy of Regime Security, State Business Networks in Syria. He also serves on the editorial committee of Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bassam Haddad.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly, the Assad clan are increasingly isolated in the Arab world, with the Arab League calling for Syria's ejection. Then King Abdullah of Jordan, speaking to the BBC, says if Bashar has the interest of his country at heart, he would step down. But he would also create an ability to reach out and start a new phase of Syrian political life. What is your reaction? Is this likely to have any effect?
I'm not sure if King Abdullah is actually the person to talk about reform. And that's why these words are not really going to matter very much, given what is happening or what has been happening in his own country. I would focus more on the situation in Syria, inside Syria, which has become unbearable as the death toll has reached 4,000 dead. It is basically an issue of regime brutality crushing the protesters. And that is the larger picture, which is not to be mistaken because of the evidence that we have from the first day where the protesters were not violent, and yet they were also, you know, shut down and crushed. However, it is also important to recognize that the battle has changed and that now we have armed personnel within the opposition, and we have army defectors who have actually joined the opposition and now are fighting with using weapons. So now the situation is becoming more unclear, although we should not lose sight of the structural problem, which is the regime crushing of the protesters. That does not mean that we absolve the regime, definitely. It does mean, however, that the course of events are no longer as, you know, black and white as they were earlier. And it is important to recognize that while condemning the regime is the first priority of anyone with conscience, it is also important to be mindful of the problematic escalation of this conflict to the point where external intervention becomes an option, a real option. That will actually benefit no one in this situation, not least the Syrian people. So I feel that it's more important to have a clear view of what the opposition wants. It's also more important for the opposition itself to become far more organized and far less disjointed and get over their quibbles that have actually been rather embarrassing in the past couple of weeks, and mount a serious effort, collective effort, to stick to the basic demands. Instead, much of the opposition is in disarray about questions that would have to be dealt with after the transition or the fall of the regime. So it's a very complex situation. And anyone who basically presents it as a very straightforward situation of regime against protesters, as if it's actually just a local issue and just an issue of violence against unarmed opposition, it's actually not. It's more complex than that. With the caveat that no scenario and no narrative should absolve the regime's violence.
Well, there was a very compelling piece on Frontline recently, where a courageous young woman snuck inside Syria and was able to film the opposition. And it was chilling how oppressive that regime is. I mean, if you're a supporter, if you're on the government payroll, if you go out and demonstrate on behalf of the Assads, or if you're an Alawite, a part of the insider clan, that's one thing. But to be on the wrong side of that regime is scary beyond belief. I'd be surprised if the opposition could do anything under those conditions, and I'm continually astounded at the enormous courage of the Syrian people to stand up against snipers and tank fire. I mean, you wouldn't find anybody over here doing that, I can guarantee you.
No, I mean, you wouldn't find that in a normal situation, even in Syria. Keep in mind that there was not some sort of a I don't know what to even call it, but some sort of a pill that everybody has been taking for 30 some years, and then all of a sudden they stopped taking it, and now they woke up to the reality of oppression, political oppression, economic deterioration, and lack of avenues for redress to struggle for the rights. It's basically a situation that has been getting worse over the years and gotten to the point where people were willing to actually do this, because at some point this act is completely irrational, because you know that others will not join you because of the level of, let's say, destitution or hopelessness or desperation has not reached a certain point. But now it has, and that's why you see people just like in Tunisia and Egypt not concerned about doing this and actually doing that. Look at the Occupy Wall Street movement. You know, people don't feel that it's rational to begin doing certain things at this point, because they know that there will not be, you know, followed by other protesters, besides the fact that the situation is completely different. What I'm trying to say is that even a year ago, when the situation was not that structurally different, people were not doing what they are doing today. It's been triggered by Tunisia, and that trigger created a collective consciousness that allowed people to feel that now, if they actually do so, they will be followed by others, and they will not just be alone, because over the years and the decades, people have protested, and people have gone against the regime, and they actually suffered a horrible fate. And they alone suffered a horrible fate. That's why these numbers, these people were few. I don't want to say far in between, because people continue to protest over the years nonstop, but there were few of them.
And now there have been thousands and thousands of have protest, but then the official figure is, 3,500 to 4,000. It's probably much higher than that. It is amazing that people still go out after Friday prayers and put their lives on the line. What's your understanding, though, Bassam Haddad, of the regime's confidence that it can stay on? I'm told by a former specialist on Iran from the National Security Council that in spite of our analysts saying that Turkey's the new power in the region and Iran is going to lose Syria, what's your understanding of why this regime appears to be confident, why the Iranians apparently are confident that they can win at the end of the day? They would seem, in a broad sense, to be on the wrong side of history.
They are on the wrong side of history because of the violence that they've unleashed on the Syrian people for several decades now. And at this point, it's much less the question of them being confident. It's much more a question of them having no choices left. After having actually engaged in the kind of oppression that they have engaged in over the years, and after having a situation where after 8 months, they've actually killed more than 3,000 people directly, if you want to account for others that have, you know, been killed, in other words, soldiers or army officers that have been killed in the other direction, but at least 3,500 Syrian protesters were killed. After that situation, the regime is unable to make a sincere compromise that will be considered credible. So the regime is basically continuing with its zero-sum game approach, knowing that the only choice is fight until the end. Other options of compromise have always been considered, and some laws or stipulations were issued, but they were completely not credible. Even the agreements that the regime agreed to with the Arab League or otherwise, I mean, they violated them as they were actually signing those agreements. And of late, they violated the agreement to cease fire, so to speak. And last week, according to what the Arab League and Syria decided, and they continued with the same exact pattern. Now, one can speak of movements, you know, or armed gangs, as the regime would like to say, and it's not untrue. It's not completely made up by the regime. But it's not like the regime is only targeting these armed gangs. They are actually targeting everyone. So that excuse, you know, even if it's partially, it has some truth to it in the sense that parts of the opposition are armed or the defectors from the army are naturally armed, it doesn't explain why peaceful protesters are being killed in peaceful protests. And the camera shows this across the country.
Well, again, the frontline piece, which was very, very powerful, made it very clear that ordinary people are just terrorized and young people are picked up in the middle of the night by these roaming gangs of security people who come in and trash the homes and take away the young men and beat up the parents and leave with signs on the building saying, "We love you, Bashar." And they also interviewed a number of Syrian army defectors still in their fatigues, but they weren't armed. So it's not clear to me, you may be able to escape from the army base, but I don't think you can escape with a weapon, can you? I mean, the Alawite officer corps and the security people have all the army locked down, don't they? I don't think they can defect with their weapons, can they?
No, I mean, look, they have control of anything at the middle and upper middle levels. But they cannot control the average soldier with his rifle, and that's been the majority of the cases of defections. There have been defections at higher levels, but they were extremely rare.
Where is the break going to come then, if it is to come? You have Turkey next door creating a kind of safe zone. In they even evacuated their diplomats a couple of days ago. They're taking a very strong stance. The Europeans are just increasing sanctions on Syria. Where is this regime vulnerable and where is it likely to crack?
Economically. The problem that the regime will be facing in a few months, even if things continue for a few months, we're not talking 10 months, we're talking more like 5 or 6 months, is that the regime will ultimately end up being... end up running out of funds, basically, to fund this campaign. And they will, of course, they are deprived of certain revenues, whether it's from oil or otherwise. So they will actually have to face a situation where the oppression of the protesters or the military campaign that they are leading will not be sustainable in the long run. And that will spark a debate internally at the highest levels that might end up in some sort of schism or some sort of compromise that, you know, the people will actually believe as a result of the kind of, you know, the kind of rarity that it would provide, because the regime will not actually come to terms unless it really, really must.
Well, just in closing, Bassam Haddad, the Arab League are going to discuss Syria again on Wednesday. Is there anything that they can do? Clearly, the Europeans and the West are staying out of this. Is there anything that can be done on a regional basis?
I do not feel that this is the right time right now to do that. I do not feel that the Syrian regime feels that it's the right time to do this, especially after this decision by the Arab League. I think that regional intervention might be more effective a bit more down the line. Unfortunately, not today, not at this point.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Bassam Haddad.
Thank you for talking to me.
Again, I've been speaking with Bassam Haddad, who's the director of the Middle East Studies Program at George Mason University. He's also a visiting professor at Georgetown University and serves as a founding editor of the Arab Studies Journal. His latest book on Syrian political economy is The Political Economy of Regime Security, State Business Networks in Syria. He also serves on the editorial committee of Middle East Report. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the GOP became the party of the rich.